Mr. Mason, ring 5.
For their power and their efficiency and doing always what they said they'd do. And this is why I say that I believe the Germans respected the Greeks respected the Germans and still do. They don't seem to be, I mean, some countries where certain other nations have occupied that country, there's still a lot of hate towards those people. But I haven't found in Greece today that there's any real antagonism or hatred towards the Germans. Still a bit towards the Italians.
Did any of them actually like the Germans?
Well, that was difficult to discover. No, I should say they didn't particularly like them. I suppose there were collaborators in the towns. Certainly there were collaborators amongst the, you know, young women, Greek women, and the German soldiery, but then that's not unexpected. I mean, that happens everywhere with occupied troops. But, no, generally speaking, they kept out of their way. I don't think there was much cooperation between Greek and German.
Did they ever say anything about Turkish rule over Greece in the past? Was that ever mentioned?
Well, the Turks were all second-rate, second-class citizens, and we met a number of Turks in the mountains, and they would be referred to slightingly as Turks. They had particular names for them, I suppose. They weren't the true Greeks. They looked upon them as the downtrodden and the peasants in much the same way, although the Cypriots wouldn't like to hear this, but in the same way as the Cypriots treated the Turks in Cyprus itself. There's no love lost between Turk and Greek, but there again that goes back into far history, doesn't it? The battles between Turk and Greek, been going on for years.
How nationalistic were the Greek villagers? Were they proud of being Greeks?
Oh yes, very proud of being Greeks. And always thought of themselves as a sort of similar civilization to ourselves, as brothers, the British and the Greeks. Where this tradition grew up, I don't know, but Greeks and British, strange enough, always have been very friendly towards one another.
You don't think it was put on just because...
No, I don't. Oh, I think I'm going back before the wars. I think, and since. Oh, the Greeks are fond of the British, if fond is the right word, and the British, any British that have even gone on holiday to Greece would tell you how friendly the Greeks are towards the British. Extremely friendly towards the British. And they look upon the British as brothers. I found this countless number of times. In fact, if you go to Greece on holiday, it's the one country in the world where you are truly welcomed. Not for your money necessarily, or not for your money at all. But they do like and love the British. They really do. And the British, when they meet Greeks in their own country, feel the same. It's rather different in this country because we're not meeting real Greeks. We're meeting Cypriot business people who like to be called Greeks, who like to think of themselves as Greeks. But to the Greek, a Cypriot is not a true Greek at all. He's quite a different person. And the Cypriots, whether they like it or not, are looked upon by the Greeks as sort of second-class citizens. And we found this in Greece itself because we had some Cypriots with us, working for us. And they used to look after the mules and do the more menial tasks. And the only thing I can say is that they were not respected by the true Greek.
You said when you got there you were surprised at getting through to Cairo straight away. Why were you surprised?
Well, it's always a chancy business when you are dropped into a country to open up a wireless set. The power we are using on the set is very low. They were only small sets, whereas the sets sending to us, the signal was always very easy to pick up because of the power, which was probably four or five, even more times, more powerful than our sets. We were sending on a very weak signal, in effect, for the size of set. And even at, say, 600 miles, and depending where you are in relation to the hills, the mountains, the trees, the country around you, depended to a great extent on whether you could be heard at all. This comes into radio screening, which, of course, John Brown is an absolute expert on that. For instance, if you are on top of a mountain with a very weak, small-powered set, there'd be no difficulty, providing the set was operating properly. With a nice aerial, there's no difficulty in you sending, say, a couple hundred miles, or 600 miles, or 1,000 miles. But if you're tucked down into a valley, as I say, surrounded by hills, by trees, buildings even, then it's a very different story. Screening is all important, you see. So the position I was in, which was on a mountainside, looking north, and Cairo south, it's always a little bit of a wonder and a pleasant surprise to get through as quickly as that, you see. Then there's the difficulty of the actual set manipulation. You've got a very narrow band of frequency to work on, and although you're given the exact frequency that the base will send to you, at times finding that signal amongst all the other signals coming in, don't forget, I mean, there are countless numbers of stations on the air, all the countries in the world. And so you've got to pick out three little letters coming into you. And the chap at t'other end has got to do the same thing. Whereas he has a better receiver, a more sensitive receiver, it's probably easier for him. But it's not that easy. Once you've established communication, then you're away. You know exactly where to find him next time on your dial. He knows where to find you, providing you all know the times that you're supposed to be sending and keeping the correct time, then the thing, if you're a trained operator, well, this is the whole job. This is what it's all about. The same thing applied later in Malaya. That was 1,600 miles I was sending, and there I was amongst trees 150 feet high, in a wet rainforest. Anything could happen there. You could be operating over sort of a tin area, which I'm told is a very bad area to be working a wireless set. All sorts of things come into this wireless business. If you remember that the set is not much bigger than that suitcase there, contained in a thing that size. Especially made by John Brown, of course, for agents working in the field.
But this is not a suitcase we're referring to. It's like a briefcase, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's bigger than that, but yes, it's thicker than that. Not much wider or deeper. Yes, deeper, but.
And you're transmitting to Sri Lanka then, Ceylon.
Yes, at that time. Yes. There again, as I've written somewhere else, I dropped into Malaya and in the afternoon or early evening, and my first sked, it wasn't until the next evening, that's true, they gave you about 12-24 hours to sort yourself out. And when I set my gear up, you know, the set, the batteries and everything, the aerial, there again, switched on the set, listened out, heard the station in Colombo coming through loud and clear. And then the trick is, you've got him all right, now is he going to get me? So as soon as he stops, you start on your signal, and you can't hear whether he's picked you up until you stop sending and switch over. And then there's that lovely sensation when you switch over, you hear him belting back at you, "Yes, I've got you loud and clear." And that is a quite an exciting moment, especially at that distance with that set in those conditions.
Now, we've moved there from Greece to Malaya.
Yes.
Maybe you can backtrack a bit now.
Yes.
And you can tell me...
Well, life went on more or less peacefully, not in the village of Mbele, which is our headquarters. I was mainly occupied with the wireless set, charging batteries. Then another operator came in to join me, Sergeant Ken Carey, who came from Bexhill, I think. And we worked together. He did most of the coding. And then another operator came in, so there were three of us in the end. I did most of the wireless operating. They got on with the coding and so on and so forth. And the three of us were reasonably static. The others used to set off on little sabotage parties if they thought there was a convoy needed to be taken out. On one occasion they went down and ambushed a German convoy on the main road going up country, and shot them up and brought back a lot of goodies with them. One was a charging engine, which I was pleased to see, a Bosch charging set, which I used, much better than our equipment, and brought back a lot of food, great Parmesan cheese, I remember, they brought back with them. And so we, as operators, stayed there and simply worked the set. We coded and decoded messages to do with intelligence of the movements of the Germans, where their strong points were, what they were doing, number of vehicles, number of tanks moving in and out, and all that sort of thing. It was mainly intelligence stuff we were sending all the time. There was quite a lot of movement went on. You see, they'd transfer, say, a division from Greece to Russia or something like that. That happened on one occasion, reducing the German forces in Greece. In fact, I think two or three divisions went from Greece to Russia. And then finally, I think this was after the Germans knew, not realized, that the invasion wasn't going to be in Greece, but in Italy, because the word was, they tried to give the impression, or the Allies tried to give the impression, that the invasion from the Mediterranean would be, or in the Mediterranean, would be in Greece, you see, would be to invade Greece first and go up that way. Well, then when the Allies invaded Italy, the Germans knew that Greece was more or less finished. It was no good to them. So they virtually withdrew their troops to a line further up, you know, back up through Yugoslavia to defend, really, northern Italy. And so that was the end of them in Greece and Yugoslavia. They just moved out. And that was in, as I've said, late November, early December 1944, yes. Well, then we came down from the hills, as it were, down to the nearest town to us was a place called Tricola. We more or less liberated it, and there was a lot of joy and festivity and so on.
What was the liberation of Tricola like?
Oh, well, of course, the Greeks were glad to see the back of the Germans, and for the first time in years they were more or less free, as they thought in the first instance, until the communists sort of started to lay down the laws, what they should do and what they shouldn't do. And they were more frightened of the communists, I should think, than some of the Germans, really. Because the communists really wanted to take over, you see. And they took control of these towns. Trikola, Larissa was another big town. The communists set up their headquarters in both those towns. And then by this time, the British had landed in Piraeus. Some had dropped into the Peloponnesus, an airdrop, which was a bit of a disaster. But gradually, the British forces moved up country. Then there was the political troubles that went on in Athens between the various factions. Alas, then were fighting our troops, or we were fighting them.
Did you see anything of that?
I did not, no. We never got down to Athens. Well, I think if we had, we might have been in some trouble. No, we moved from across country to a port, Volos, on the east coast. And there we were more or less threatened by the Greek communists that we were going to be imprisoned and held as hostages. But I don't know whether they were serious or not. I mean, events turned out, you know, they could have done this, would have done it perhaps, because they captured a lot of our British troops and kept them for some months before they were liberated.
Which month would this have been?
This would be November, December. Yes, December, 44. Anyway, we got to Volos and managed to get on to a ship taking Italian POWs back to Italy.
So how seriously did you take those threats?
Oh, quite seriously. Quite seriously.
But
yes,
did they
were quite glad to get away.
Did they act on their threats?
No.
They didn't act in any way on their threats?
No. We boarded the small steamer full of Italian POWs, and headed south around the Peloponnesus, right round into the Mediterranean, and landed in Brindisi, was it? Brindisi. There we went to, from there we went to an SOE camp near Monopoli in the hills. I suppose the nearest large town would be Bari. We were just in transit, but actually spent Christmas Day in a village nearby, Castellani, I think it was called. Castellani was the centre of SOE operations at that time in Italy. So we were there for Christmas Day 1944, and shortly after that we went back to Brindisi. I say we, that's the little party from Mavrelli, about a dozen of us, where we got on board an American ship heading towards, which was heading towards back to the Suez area. And there we landed again a few days later. A train back to Cairo and back to Rustam Buildings, where we were, well, debriefed, I suppose. Then we were given local leave. I think seven of us stuck together then, all wireless operators, who we, I suppose, had met, we'd met up before. And we were given local leave, put into one of the Cairo hotels, which was paid for by SOE. And we were given pocket money and had quite a pleasant time. And then one day we were called into Rustam again, into one of the offices, to see one of our signals, colonel, I think, who asked us if we would volunteer for the same sort of operation in the Far East. And the whole seven of us said, no, thank you very much. To be mixed up with the German-occupied territory was one thing, but to be mixed up with the Japanese-occupied territory was an entirely different kettle of fish. So he said, well, hang on, we'll give you at least 10 days leave in England before you go, and we'll pay you another 10 shillings a day, which was very unusual. So, of course, we were dying to get a bit of leave in England, so that decided us, really. So we all said, yes, well, we would volunteer. I suppose he thought we were very mercenary, but still. So we came to England on a troop ship. Of course, no one knew at that time how long the war was going to continue. The war in Europe was over by then. Or was it? No, not quite. Not quite, but getting on towards the end of the war in Europe. So we came back to England, had our leave, assembled again at Henley-on-Thames. We seven of us still stuck together. We were taken, I think, again to Southampton, and off we set for Bombay on the ship called the Orion, on its own, a single ship, no escorts, a very fast liner, which left Southampton. I think it was a P&O Orion, and arrived in Bombay, oh, I think, in absolute record time. Actually belted through the Mediterranean, through Suez, across to Bombay in record time. And in record time, we were put on a train at Bombay, and we went by train from there the whole length of India, passing through Madras, I think changing at Madras when I think about it, and down to Ceylon, or Sri Lanka as we now know it, to our headquarters, which was at Colombo. And the actual SOE camp was a few miles from Colombo, and it was called Harana, or ME-25, I think it was known as. So,
what did it consist of?
Just a jungle training camp. Rifle ranges, jungle tracks, and they put you through this jungle bit, you know.
Harana, did you say?
Harana. H-O-R-A-N-A. Harana. It was quite a pleasant period, really, at that camp. We were allowed into Colombo, which was a very fine city in those days. In fact, I loved Ceylon. I thought it was a most delightful place. We weren't there very long, or at least I wasn't there very long. I was called in one day and said that, I told that a wireless set in Malaya had gone off the air. They hadn't heard from him for 2 or 3 weeks. And they had a message from another station to say the operators couldn't get the set going or get in touch. And I would be sent in there with a new set, new charging equipment, batteries and so on, to establish or re-establish communication. Two officers went in, as well. So the three of us went from Colombo to Trincomalee, China Bay as it was known, by the Navy. And from there we flew in a Liberator, 1,400 miles across to northern Kedah. Quite an air trip, even for those days. The Liberators could just about carry the three of us and our kit, and the rest of the aircraft was simply a petrol tanker. Petrol tanks were in the bomb bays, which was still only enough to carry out the 14 to 15 hour flight. In fact, many of those Liberators returning from such a trip had to throw everything movable overboard, their guns, any spare equipment, even to reach their base in Trincomalee. So it was quite a, well, call it a hairy flight for the pilots.
Who was in the party who was being taken?
There were two officers who were given some particular jobs, I don't quite know. I wasn't attached to them. My job was to, as I said, establish communication at this main camp to take up where these other two had failed, apparently. Now, when we reached the coast of Malaya, this is in daylight, of course, we didn't know it at the time, but just north of the position where we crossed the sea into the land, into the mountains and so on behind, at a place called Sungi Batani, not far away, 50, 60 miles perhaps up the road, perhaps a bit further than that, there was a Japanese fighter station. We saw those fighters later, Zeros, plenty of them. And why they didn't come up to us, I really don't know. I sat in the co-pilot's seat all for half the way across, and then as we reached the coast of Malaya, the Liberator came down to just above sea level, I suppose to avoid the Japanese radar, and then zoomed up over the trees into the higher ground where we were due to drop. And the pilot then said to me, "You better get back and get your parachute on, and good luck and safe landing," and so on. So I went back into the rear compartment, where the dispatcher had put up a slide, like a child's slide, which led to the square opening in the bottom of the Liberator. And the three of us, who by then had got our parachutes on, sat on this slide, looking backwards, just seeing the trees pass below us. And I remember saying to the officer in front of me, "Can you see the D